Hello and welcome to edition 411 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the show this week, we'll be hearing from Lauren Greenfield, the photographer and documentary maker whose new collection of images takes a sceptical look at the gaudy lives of the super rich and those that want to be like them.
Plus, we'll be joined by the medical historian Richard Barnett. His new book, The Smile Stealers, looks at the history of dentistry. No jokes about pulling teeth.
Oh.
We'll have to grin and bear it, Tom.
That we will. And we'll be discussing music with Aaron Holloway-Nahum, the leader of contemporary composing outfit The Riot Ensemble. We'll be telling us why we should be getting inspired by what's around us and not just by composers like him.
All that plus Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan will be hitting some bum notes in the news look ahead as well. That's all happening on the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24. Tom, here we are. It's been a while, hasn't it, since the two of us have skipped merrily down the garden path that is the Sunday Monocle Weekly.
Indeed, but you've been a busy man, Rob. You've been, I don't know.
Who knows?
I've been meaning to ask you, where have you been and what have you been doing? I think you've been on some writing trips. I think you maybe...
Yeah,
I
worked... Well,
did you take
last
a vacation,
weekend,
possibly?
I had a two-week vacation in which I tried to renovate a house with the help of my parents and my wife.
Tried to? I mean, with... What border end product?
So, well, actually, at the moment, it now looks like a house rather than like a building site. There are still quite a lot of dusty corners, building site-y elements, things in boxes, all the rest of it, all that fun of the fair, which I know you've gone through yourself.
Indeed.
Fairly recently. That's been good. And last week, I was dancing in Tel Aviv for a story, which is going to appear in the July-August edition of Monocle, really pulling full circle the fact that I won't go anywhere unless it is a thinly disguised holiday.
Exactly.
Okay, then that's fine.
I was going to say that, but I felt it would be inappropriate. But actually...
Tel Aviv is a great place.
I've not had the pleasure. I've been meaning to travel there.
Beautiful people, dance steps.
A kind of old-fashioned party town. And I don't mean that pejoratively.
Yeah. What, you mean like South End?
end of the pier vibe.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's got a bit of a kind of, not that you want to over-egg the pudding that is, oh, people live differently in places that are slightly less safe or in a slightly more, you know, fractious part of the world than our own. Far be it for us to decide that. But it does have a vibe. It does have a going all night vibe to it, which is super cool, which hopefully we've captured in some beautiful photographs. And that'll be in the next issue of Monocle. It's good stuff.
Because I didn't realise that it is actually part of your official rider at Monocle that you participate in a conga line. And
yeah.
Someone said that to me and I thought, oh, yes, that's a funny joke about Rob if you know him a little.
Yeah.
It's literally true, clearly.
It's got to be, yeah, exactly. There has to be one. I mean, every 6 months there has to be a story in which a conga line features. I have to be certainly within spitting distance of the middle of the photograph. Right?
I was going to say, but what about the conga line? Where's your preferred... This could go in any direction, but where's your preferred location within the conga line?
Right at the back.
Let's just leave that one there. Who's sashaying into the studio right now?
Look who it is, talking of right at the back.
Hanging out the back of a conga line.
Here he is, HRS. Henry, oh Henry. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Rob. How's it going?
Not bad. How are you?
Very well. Tom?
Henry, good afternoon to you. I like to think of you as the shaven emu of news.
On the 24th of May, US President Donald Trump is going to be meeting Pope Francis and the Italian president, apparently in Rome. Now, this is going to be, I think, one of the stages of Trump's Magical Mystery Bus tour that he's embarking on. He arrived... yesterday, I believe, in Saudi Arabia, where he is trying to woo various eminences of the Arab world.
Okay.
There. It's his first trip abroad, and he's going to essentially the three centres of the Abrahamic religions.
Is he going to Mecca? Is he going to go to the Vatican City?
Also Israel, precisely.
Okay.
Yeah.
My favourite detail so far about his trip is that there's a particular landmark that all the visiting US presidents to Israel always go to, and they fly in a helicopter nearby, and then they take a cable car to the top of this famous fort, because it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And Trump said, I'll only go there if I can fly and land my helicopter directly on top of the UNESCO World Heritage Holy Relic. And they said, well, obviously you can't do that because, as you know, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Monument. So he said, fine, I'm not going then.
Really?
Which is the political equivalent of a kid taking his ball home to the playground, which I think is it's instructive.
That is quite amazing. From that small detail, many, many larger truths can be told. One assumes.
He's going to have quite the entourage. I do want to go into some of the details here. Okay. When he is in Saudi Arabia, apparently American country singer Toby Keith is to perform to a male-only crowd in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. So that should be a sight for sore eyes and ears, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
Trump will probably love that, won't he? That sounds like his kind of party.
Yeah, I think that has actually been arranged by the Saudi hosts to try to impress both their subjects, as it were.
Oh, really?
And I think so, and Trump.
Everyone's
at the same time. Everyone's getting involved.
A meeting of minds, if you will.
Indeed. And I also want to...
down in Mecca is a strange kind of thing.
That sounds like the headline to one of your stories, Rob. I can imagine appearing in an upcoming issue of Monocle magazine.
It's got conga written all over it.
Exactly. And moving on to now a former president and his travels. On the 26th of May, the former US President Barack Obama is going to be attending a charity dinner in Edinburgh. And then before that, on the 25th of May, he's going to be in Berlin, marking the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Church. I don't want to go into too many details about these specific events, but it is interesting, isn't it, that he's kind of done a Tony Blair, hasn't he?
Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, because I think he got quite a lot of heat for giving a very expensive Hillary-esque speech to Wall Street last year. And now he went on holiday with Richard Branson, didn't he?
Yeah.
And now he's kind of touring around doing various charity dinners. It must be difficult to resist, mustn't it, once you've held an office of that levity, gravity rather. You know, how do you put that immense cultural capital to work in the best way?
I guess a sceptic might say...
Highest bidder, surely.
You could simply say, I'm quite happy to get paid lots of money to do talks, but maybe I won't take the money from this institution that I spent quite a lot of my presidency...
having a go at.
Decrying.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a suggestion.
I think that's good. I think that this is why Tom Edwards is going to end up on the...
In jail.
No, not in jail.
On the
PR team for future presidents.
I think
this is good.
Yeah,
good
future
advice.
Presidents, not the current one.
I think you're probably...
You could do your best, but you're probably struggling, aren't you?
You're struggling with a man that wants to land a helicopter on the top of a temple.
Interesting.
What else is happening? If you've got that sort of... there's an app, isn't there, called Find Your Friends, I think, where if your friends collude with you in the service, you can kind of look. I know people in the office upstairs have it. It freaks me out. I hope I'm not on it. But anyway, have you got this for kind of world leaders, Henry? It seems like you know what Obama's up to, what Trump's up to.
I haven't got that. I would like that. On the 23rd of May, it is World Turtle Day.
Oh, it's about time they got to look in, those guys.
It really is, isn't it? Yeah. Now, is there a meaningful difference between a turtle and a tortoise?
Of course there is.
Go on. Difference.
What is it?
Come on, Henry. Well, no, give us the definitions. I'm sure you've researched this.
No, I actually genuinely...
Tortoises can't swim, can they?
Or is it the other way around?
No, a tortoise is a land-based...
Tortoise is a land-based...
A land-based mammal.
And the turtle
is a mammal?
Has flippers.
Reptile. Let's not get into that.
No, because it lays eggs.
Amphibian.
Lays eggs.
Well, it's not an amphibian.
It lays eggs, so it's not a mammal.
And a turtle is a fine swimmer. Sadly, turtles were at one point at least thought delicious to eat. So then not very many of them around. But I love those guys.
Did you know I have a good story about eating tortoise and when people were travelling by the oceans during those amazing voyages of discovery from the sort of 14th century onwards? And the thing about tortoise, as you know, is it doesn't require much water to drink in an ongoing basis. So if you say stack up, I don't know, say you've been visiting the Galapagos Islands, stack up 10 giant tortoises, you know, in the mess on your vessel, they stay alive and they're amazing to eat and they have water inside.
Oh, really?
So it's like a packed lunch. So you crack it in half, you cook the meat, which is apparently delicious, and you get a refreshing water.
What? So it's just... you can,
and it doesn't even require preservation because it's just alive.
But surely you don't decant the water somehow from
the tortoise. I imagine you crack it open like a coconut. But I haven't researched that fully. And I also, I'd feel that would be inhumane. But that was their...
That was what they did.
It was their fault. They were so tasty and practical.
Yeah, it's tough.
They're like a thermos.
Have you thought about becoming,
in those days?
Have you thought about becoming an ambassador for World Turtle Day?
It'd be good, wouldn't it?
You could extol their...
I think I'd be a turtle disaster at that.
on that note.
He's never off, is he?
Brilliant.
It's good stuff. Well, thank
I'm so
you
sorry for that.
Drawing our attention to that. And we've kind of, I mean, people will wonder what on earth we do all day if we don't know the difference between a turtle and a tortoise.
Well, I didn't. You...
As far according to Tom Edwards, a tortoise is even more delicious.
That's the answer from now on that I'll refer to.
Tortoise can't be eaten anymore. It's like keeping them as pets. If you've got one that's 100, you can keep it, but you can't buy a new one. Is that right? Something like
I think
that.
Something like that, yeah. They're old timers, aren't they? When it comes to topics guaranteed to pull in listeners on a relaxing Sunday lunchtime, obviously Tom and I's first thought was dentistry. Now, you may think a trip to the dentist is a thing to be avoided at all costs, but one man would beg to differ.
Richard Barnett is a writer, teacher and broadcaster on the cultural history of science and medicine. In his latest book, The Smile Stealers, The Fine and Foul Art of Dentistry, traces the history of the field from the first set of dentures recorded in the 7th century BC, maybe those are your ones, Rob, to why we all began smiling in photos in the last couple of hundred years. He joins us to tell us more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Richard. Very
Thanks.
Good to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
Before we talk about the beautiful thing that is the Smile Stealers, we should remind our listeners that it's the latest in a series of works. You do seem to enjoy... What can I say? The macabre side of medicine? Is that a fair point?
I think our aim with the series was to make a series of coffee table books that nobody would want on a coffee table, really. The sort of in-house nickname for this series in Thames and Hudson, The Welcome, has been The Elegy. So we now have three, as you rightly say, beautifully designed. I do always like to give full credit. I feel very lucky to have my name on the spines of these books. These really have been a collaborative project. The fantastic design shops of Thames and Hudson, the remarkable collections, the research skill of the Wellcome Library. As I say, in many ways, I've sort of simply come in and arranged and written about these things.
And as you say, the some of the pictures are amazing. That's a good bit of research, an amusing bit of research, presumably, to be doing amongst the Wellcome. Archives. So these are awful, as Tom says, macabre items of both teeth and the things that are designed to rip them out of your gob.
I mean, one of the joys of the Wellcome is that you any line of macabre thinking that springs to mind, you can pursue. It's all about the body and the various ways in which that's been sort of transformed and treated down the centuries. But this was especially disgusting. there's something about...
I didn't
about...
see that in the quotes on the...
That'd be such a good... Can we have that one? Can we add to the for the paperback edition, perhaps?
Yeah. Actually, if I could have exceptionally disgusting the monocle, I would be delighted with that. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get some T-shirts made.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be good stuff. Yeah.
But tell us a bit more then about the actual sort of narrative arc here of this book, because it zeroes in on the wild and the macabre, but it's also, again, I think these are themes that run through your other writings. It's a sort of a social history, and dentistry is one of those things, and people's teeth. They sort of permeate. There's an interesting, you know, the different times and when people value different things or the perception of what teeth should be changed. And that's also a very interesting arc that you cover through the book, isn't it?
I was very struck researching this, that in many ways the history of dentistry is the history of something that I imagine is very dear to the hearts of Monocle readers and listeners, and that's the history of style, the
extreme
history of gentility.
Vanity.
Extreme vanity. Let's say style and manners and gentility. I mean, if you partly, of course, dentistry is about having a functioning mouth. We all need to breathe and eat and speak. But there's much more than this. It's about what we would now call self-presentation. It's very striking, for example, if you read, as I did, the very first books in the European tradition on self-presentation, the books of manners, the books for courtiers produced in the 15th and 16th century, they're all about the mouth. They're all basically saying, keep your mouth shut as far as possible, partly for physical reasons, because everybody has disgusting breath at this time and everybody has black teeth, but partly for cultural reasons as well. It's a way of showing wisdom. You know, you don't kind of blabber on, you don't chatter on, you don't expose people either to your stupid ideas or your stupid breath. So right from the start, dentistry is about, as I say, self-presentation. It's about how you come across. It's about changing ideas of beauty.
There's something interesting in this also about the idea of the dentist. Even in the blurb, I think we were told early on that it was a kind of freak show, it was a circus. It was a job you'd have in a sort of travelling circus. When did it become a branch of medicine, and was it trusted as such at the beginning?
I think to an extent, we do have this image, I think, of the medieval tooth puller, you know, with the necklace of rotten molars that they've pulled out. To an extent, that's an exaggeration. I mean, a lot of that comes from satirical paintings in the Dutch tradition, the 15th and 16th century. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Early, you can't really call it dentistry, early tooth pulling was a violent business. It was often done in public. It was done at fairs and markets and so on. And you did have...
In a public as place as possible, obviously.
In as public a place as possible. Course. So it was entertainment. It was... Yeah. It was. I often wonder if it's a kind of... a strange kind of anaesthesia in some ways that you must be so anxious about this being done in public that you're much less worried about the pain that's
Well, I was going to ask you why you think there was that theatricality associated with it, in a way that not a lot of other intimate surgeries were still rather done behind closed doors.
Well, a lot of... It's very striking, of course, the places we do surgery and anatomy are called theatres. There's something very performative about early surgery. A lot of early surgery in this period is done, if not in front of a huge audience, at least in front of an audience of sorts. And, of course, this is a culture that's very familiar with spectacle and pain. This is a culture that loves public executions and bear baiting and all that sort of thing. So it's a culture that has a very much harder attitude towards physical pain than ours. But the first practitioners to call themselves dentists emerge in Paris at the end of the 17th century, and they're very much reacting against that. It's rather striking that when dentistry first appears as it's not yet a profession, but it's trying to be a profession, it's not based on a new set of knowledge, it's based on a set of attitudes, a new kind of social position that dentists are going for. The first people to call themselves dentists aren't offering radical new therapies. What they're offering is an increased attention to the sensibility of patients. So if you think about the kind of cliched foppish courtiers at the court of the Sun King, people whose status derives not from their skill on the battlefield, but from their sort of their self-presentation, their wit. We're getting into a sort of Enlightenment idea of gentility and self-presentation here. They don't want to be kind of held between the knees of some great hulking tooth puller in public. They want somebody who is as perfumed and as well-dressed and as sensitive as they are. So dentistry, when it's born, is very much about the relationship between dentists and their patients. It's very much about the ambitions of dentists. It's not so much about new techniques.
Well, this is an interesting thing because there is something about... There is always... I feel like maybe in a David Lynch film or in any... or maybe in a bit of kind of roving American fiction, I feel that there is, you know, the baddie is the dentist. Yeah. There is something socially climbing about dentists.
Absolutely.
Always is portrayed in fiction as well. Is this... Are we mad to presume this, or why are the two synonymous?
The status of dentistry within medicine, and often not within medicine, has always been really ambivalent. There's a lovely sniffy quote from the editor of the BMJ, a British medical journal in the late 19th century, saying, well, of course, medicine's a profession, whereas dentistry is a business. Yeah. And there's this very... Again, it's partly intellectual snobbery, but it's partly social snobbery. Medicine itself has always had status anxiety about whether it's a trade or a profession and its association with blood and death and pain and so on. So, of course, dentistry is a wonderful thing for doctors to kind of define themselves against. You know, we're not vulgar tooth pullers. We have degrees from Oxford and Cambridge, and we have a sort of enlightened sense of our relationship with patients, and we have this learned tradition, and these guys are just tooth pullers, you know, kind of wiping their pelicans and their tooth keys on their apron and diving into somebody else's mouth. So yeah, it's always been a craft and then a trade and now a profession with massive status anxiety, absolutely.
Is it also to do with, I don't know what the word is, it's funny, you know, your subhead is the fine and foul art of dentistry. Is it something about this idea of obfuscation? There's a deception involved, whether it was false teeth, the very description, or teeth whitening. Is it about representing something as unlike how it actually is, you know, whereas I guess doctors are talking about the perfect function of the body, whereas dentistry always has had this illusory quality.
Absolutely. In that sense, I think it's very much tied up with the rise of urban culture, which is all about, in a sense, you know, styled, but it crudely is always about lying about yourself. It's always about remaking yourself. So yeah, I think that's part of it, the idea that dentists are helping you to put yourself forward in a way that might not be your authentic self. So I think it plays with all of those same 18th century anxieties about kind of masking and masquerading and passing as, you know, different classes in society. It's tied up with that social anxiety that goes with urban life.
Was there a formative experience for you, Richard, that got the genesis of the book?
You can name
is it the 5-year-old Richard in the dentist chair? Where does it come? Other than obviously it is a beautiful book, it is a witty book, it is a well made book. But what about the personal touch in there? There's a bit of terror seeping off the pages.
I did have a lot of dentistry done when I was young. Like a lot of people, I grew up with too many teeth in my mouth, so I didn't have a number of extractions.
If I can say that, it's a pun, of course.
Absolutely.
But,
yeah.
How many teeth did you have out, Rich? I'm interested. But we can face off over this.
Yeah. I think I had five out in the end.
A couple ahead.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Still a mouth
quite,
and a half.
Not quite in double figures, I know. Yeah. I mean, impossible to imagine now with this finely chiselled appearance.
It's a good thing this is radio, isn't it?
But overcrowding. Mm, I mean, that was one of the reasons why I always felt somehow victimised, because it was like, sort of ridiculous physical development? Where does that... Yeah, too many teeth.
Imagine having three legs.
How's that not been phased out after a few thousand years?
Exactly. One would hope evolution would have taken care of all that sort of thing. But I think it's very much part of the modern encounter with dentistry. I suspect for many people listening to this, their first encounter with dentistry will have been over perhaps 5 or 10 years getting their teeth sorted out, you know, having braces down and the chronic pain that goes with that, and maybe extractions and no doubt the kind of social obloquy and mockery that goes with that. So I think we're almost primed to be suspicious of dentists. I think almost before we're conscious, we're having dentists doing things to us that are for our own good, aesthetically at least, but which
do taking away, I guess, as a matter of habit, which isn't necessarily one would hope what your doctor is ordinarily doing.
And I think there's something about the nature of dentistry itself. There's something about it is in some ways the most physical kind of intervention that we're regularly exposed to. You know, if we go and see our doctor, he doesn't immediately plunge his hand into our mouth and start feeling around. And, you know, even as I'm sort of sitting here talking to you, I can sort of feel those gloved fingers, you know, sort of probing.
It brings a chill.
And, exactly. And that to me, the thing that I always go to is when you're having your teeth cleaned and they linger too long in one spot and it gets really hot and you get that real sort of fiery lightning pain that kind of runs through your jaw. That's the thing that makes me go, you know.
Yeah, I'm having to take a moment. Just on that point, and it's
funny.
Part of
my body is retracting into another part of my body.
Yeah. Let's not go. Let's literally not go any further into that, Rob. But there is something funny. Rob alluded to this idea of the dentist as villain, and we actually laughed before we started talking about Marathon Man and Is It Safe and these famous screen villains. Yeah. What always strikes me about dental trauma in films particularly, or in novels or works of fiction, is they can be described very lightly. There's not lots of gory and explicit pornographic detail, and yet they are the most affecting things. Aside from people who, I guess, have sensitive teeth, literally, why so sensitive? I mean, we have plenty of other sensitive parts of our body. We don't need to go into detail, but the teeth seem to have a particular... awful absolutely. Fascination. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. As we were saying, it's rather like a really good M.R. James ghost story. There's a kind of emptiness at the heart of it into which you can project your own experiences and anxieties. I think there is something peculiarly intimate about the mouth. I mean, there is the obvious physical pain. Pain in the head, pain in the mouth is very close to the centre of who we are. Although, of course, we have bodies, we perceive ourselves as being in our heads. So I think pain there is very incapacitating. You feel very, very vulnerable when you're laid back with your mouth open. And, you know, we've all had that pain of a cavity or a loose tooth or whatever it may be, and it can completely destroy every other kind of thought that's going on in the mind. Your whole being, your whole consciousness becomes focused in that little cavity. So I think that's part of it. But I think there's something else going on. You're absolutely right. There's something about putting yourself literally in the hands of somebody else. Mm. The image on the front of the book, the disembodied mouth with the extraction calipers kind of reaching in to pull out the tooth. I think that just did that.
Well, you can hear the sound, you can feel the sensation.
Yeah. What also, just finally, before you go, Richard, there's an interesting thing. I love the Kinks, and I love them because Ray Davies never got his teeth done.
Yeah.
Unlike Bowie, unlike the Stones. You know what I mean? He's a hoary old rock star, but, you know. What is that? Why do we feel that people that have had their teeth done have sold out somehow?
It's back to authenticity, isn't it? I mean, I remember when, you know, Martin Amis got his done.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
I can't remember, did he even have a sort of press conference or something? I remember them sort of being revealed to the world in a Sunday Times article or something like that. I think it is. It's that authenticity. You know, I never had mine fixed, and I spend a lot of time teaching American students who've all had their teeth fixed.
Yeah.
And there's a little part of me that goes, I kind of want to think I'm more authentic than they are in some weird way.
Yeah.
And of course, it's nonsense. You know, their teeth are probably healthier and happier than mine. But we could make all sorts of jokes about the English and their teeth. You know, but I think there is a sense of authenticity that goes with that. And I'm sticking to that.
Authentic
line.
Teeth. Teeth artist's own.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's
exactly
good.
So.
And Martin Amis does write brilliantly about teeth a lot of the time. And he writes about actually having those operations and why he had them in experience, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But the awful teeth gnawing Keith Whitehead in Dead Babies is that's enough to put your teeth on edge. Richard, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you for coming in and talking so eloquently and amusingly about the wonderful new book, which is called The Smile Stealers, The Fine and Foul Art of Dentistry, and it's out now, published by Thames and Hudson. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be discussing new and avant-garde music at the end of the show. But, Rob, here's something new and distinctly accessible. So much so, this is a band even I like. It's The National from the US of A with The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness.
That was The National from Ohio there with The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness. What a great name for a song, Tom. It's like a sort of Scrabble score, kind of, isn't it?
Well, it's one of those things, it sounds like it makes sense, yeah. But I don't know what it means.
No, it's got a bit of a... No, exactly.
I like it.
Mercurial. So, yeah, exactly. The National, they get our vote, don't they? We'll cheers to them. We'll agree.
Well, no,
them.
It's funny, they're heading over... Well, they're on a big global tour. I think they're in the UK maybe in September. Yeah. I'll be heading along.
Nice. Do it. We're going to be talking about photography just after this. Lauren Greenfield is an Emmy Award-winning photographer and filmmaker. Her documentary, The Queen of Versailles, won the Best Documentary Director Award at Sundance in 2012, and her photographs have been widely published, exhibited and collected, and her Super Bowl commercial, Like a Girl, went viral and swept the advertising awards of 2015.
For 25 years, Greenfield's been travelling the world, bearing witness to the global boom and bust economy and documenting its complicated consequences. Her latest book is Generation Wealth, a collection of some 650 photographs and accompanying interviews. The book focuses on the allure of money, how people perceive it, and how they aspire to accumulate it, even sometimes at the cost of their own well-being. A little earlier, Monocle's Georgina Godwin sat down with Lauren to hear more about it.
Lauren, this book seems to me to be about the pursuit of the American dream, and I wonder if the dream is the same for everyone and if it's changed, because it seems to have come a very long way from the original ideals of life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. How would you define the American dream?
Well, that's interesting you say the pursuit of happiness, because it makes me think of one of the characters, David Siegel from The Queen of Versailles, who says, money doesn't make you happy. It just makes you unhappy in a better section of town, which could be, in a way, the moral of the book. I think that this work covers 25 years, and one of the things that I've been really interested in is that there has been a kind of sea change in the way we see the American dream and what motivates us. And I think what you see in the work is that we've gone from the American dream defined by the Protestant ethic and the values of thrift and hard work and discipline to a dream defined by bling and celebrity and narcissism, and in a way kind of acquiring for its own sake rather than to kind of make a better life for your children.
Mm, because, of course, you grew up in Los Angeles, and that would seem to me the very epicenter of that.
I think that's where it started. It's where it started my work. But looking back, I think in a lot of ways, it's where it started for the culture. And Hollywood was a big part of that. I started with photographing kids in L.A. and how they were influenced by these values of materialism. And I think a lot of kids had parents who did work in Hollywood, and so there was something about this image-based culture that really kind of starts these trends that then go on superdrive, overdrive, as they're exported all around the world. Mm. When I went back to the pictures from the early work, one of the pictures I unearthed in this process of going through outtakes was a picture of Kim Kardashian at 12 years old. And that was kind of a great discovery, because at the time she wasn't important to me, so I didn't include her in the first book. But now, as a major kind of star of reality TV and also a kind of show that really flaunts the lifestyle of the rich, that has just been such an important driver.
Mm. Talking about your work and your work over the last 25 years, as you say, this is the culmination of a lot of those projects all coming together, each really leading on from each other. And I wonder if you could just take us through that projection.
Well, the work starts in the early 90s with kids. And I think kids reflect so honestly the values of the bigger culture. That took me to look at how this wasn't just a story about L.A., but L.A. was really the bellwether for what was happening all over the country and eventually all over the world. So I started looking at global branding and kind of the relationship between buying and identity for teenagers, but also for grown people. Then the work goes into looking at girls and gender, which in a way were a case study for how insecurity and feelings of inadequacy make you great consumers. And I spent a lot of time looking at that with regards to gender. But as the book kind of progresses, you can see how it applies to the poor in a culture that values wealth, the young in a culture that values maturity, the old in a culture that idolizes youth.
Mm. Because, of course, your work on gender gave rise to the project Like a Girl. Just tell us a little bit about that, because that was absolutely huge.
Thank you. I did a viral spot called Like a Girl, where I interviewed girls and boys about what that means to do something like a girl. And what came out was that the word girl is used as an insult. And it starts out kind of funny because people are mimicking what running like a girl looks like or fighting like a girl looks like in a cartoonish kind of caricature way. But as the spot progresses, you kind of go from laughing to crying because you realize how this derogatory use of the kind of descriptor for half the world is so disempowering. And it was a piece that we made as a little piece and kind of put it out there. And by the end of the first week, 30 million people had shared it. And now over 215 million people have seen it. And it's been incredibly gratifying because the response on social media actually changed the way the words were used. And people kind of decided that's not what like a girl meant. Is like a girl a good thing?
Actually, I don't know what it really is. If it's a bad thing or a good thing. It sounds like a bad thing.
How do you think it affects them when somebody uses like a girl as an insult?
I think it definitely drops their self-confidence and really puts them down, because during that time they're already trying to figure themselves out. And when somebody says you hit like a girl, it's like, well, what does that mean? Because they think they're a strong person. It's kind of like telling them that they're weak and they're not as good as them.
And what advice do you have to young girls who are told they run like a girl, kick like a girl, hit like a girl, swing like a girl?
Keep doing it, because it's working. Yes, I kick like a girl and I swim like a girl and I walk like a girl and I wake up in the morning like a girl, because I am a girl. And that's not something that I should be ashamed of. So I'm going to do it anyway. That's what they should do.
And of course, it's fed into your work looking at beauty as a commodity.
Yeah, in this work, I look at kind of the full spectrum of how girls are sold to and how girls are commodified, how the body is commodified. And I think it starts with girls thinking that their value or learning that their value comes from their body. And as that progresses, I kind of take it to the full conclusion, which there's a character named Brooke Taylor who becomes a prostitute from being, even though she was a college-educated social worker, because she decided, why make $20,000 in a year when you can make $20,000 in 2 days? And what I'm trying to kind of look at is that's kind of a logical reaction to the values in the culture. I'm not judging that choice. I'm more looking at the culture that makes those two equivalent for a college-educated girl.
Yeah. So, of course, what the book does is it shows us pictures of people like Brooke. For instance, her car, I Earned It, is her number plate. It's fantastic. But there are so many absolutely amazing photographs in here, each one of which tells stories on so many different levels. The cover itself of the book, I'm a Luxury, is the slogan on this woman's clearly cashmere, very expensive cardigan, with her child riding this little kind of plush pony. It says so much. Where was that taken?
That was in Russia, in an area of Moscow that they kind of call the Beverly Hills of Moscow. And it's an incredible mansion, a kind of Frank Lloyd Wright-inspired mansion. And I was looking at how in Russia and China, in these kind of post-communist worlds where revolution leveled class, how the rich were then kind of loved over-the-top luxury. And I think that this picture also speaks to how beauty has currency and how women are commodified, because her sweater literally says that she, as a beautiful woman, is a luxury.
Mm. There's a profoundly disturbing picture that I can hardly look at of a young beauty queen, which just reinforces this idea. Describe the picture to me and tell me about it.
This is a picture of Eden Wood, who is a beauty pageant star. She's making a face with her tongue that's very provocative.
She's how old?
And she's, I think she's 5 in that picture.
Jesus.
And she wears outfits. Her mother spent $100,000 on outfits and different things for the beauty pageants. And I'm looking at, you know, first of all, the idea of the beauty pageant, both literally and metaphorically, but also how in the consumer culture there is this kind of, one of the effects is the precocious sexualization of girls. And in a way, beauty pageants kind of show you the extreme, but I also show that with regular girls. That beauty pageant queen, Eden, won a lot of big pageants after her mother decided that the outfit to beat all outfits was actually a showgirl outfit with feathers. And in the book, in the sexual capital section, that opens up with contrasting a stripper who's wearing a similar outfit.
Mm. Well, let's have a look at the various sections, because each is very distinct and tells us a little bit of something else about the culture globally, but also about America. And I wonder if going through the sections, we can see a line of how this has brought us to where we are now, how the Trumpification of society, if you like, has come about.
I talked a little bit about the Princess brand and sexual capital in terms of the commodification of women. There's this chapter called The Cult of Celebrity, and fame has become a very important value, and that kind of goes through the book. But in this chapter, I really look at how fame has so much value in the world of social media, where you have people like Kim Kardashian, who they say are famous for being famous. And one of the things that struck me is with the interviews with children, if you ask children what they want to be today, they say rich and famous. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not a job. And a psychiatrist that I interviewed said that that leads to depression among kids. There's a chapter called New Aging, where I looked at if girls learn at an early age that their body has value, what happens when they age and that value fades? They do everything to retain that value. And so we see pretty draconian kind of measures with plastic surgery. So in a way, sometimes this is the hardest chapter for people to see. Mm. Although on the other hand, I think it's important because it's so everyday.
It's astonishing that there is no judgment coming through in these photographs. You let the photographs say what they're going to say. And the interviews themselves, you're not saying this is grotesque, when actually to a viewer like me, it clearly is. And that was that a difficult thing to hold your own opinion back from that?
I mean, that's kind of how I've always worked. I'm really interested. I kind of come from maybe a more, I studied visual anthropology. I try to embed for long periods of time. I try to really see the subject's point of view. And a lot of times I'm really empathizing with them in terms of my own experience. I think I've always been drawn to kind of people that I could relate to in some way. And so when I started with the LA Kids, I started with the school that I went to and kind of was inspired by my own interest and kind of desire for those things to fit in as a teenager, designer clothes or a fancy car, but also kind of my background from my parents, who were very anti-materialistic and said those things were not important and didn't let me get any of them. And so I think that that really drew me into this inquiry. But I think I find a way to relate to a lot of the different people. The New Aging section, part of how that started was I came back from a trip from Mexico when I was in my 20s and went to a dermatologist and was offered Botox. And I didn't even know I had wrinkles. It was kind of like like learning that you have a problem, which I think is one of the things that consumerism does. It teaches you that you have a problem and then gives you a way to solve it. And that leads to something else.
Mm. Of course, there is a huge problem in the book, which is the fall. We suddenly see everybody has all this money. And then, of course, here comes 2008. And it's gone. One of the stories that really encapsulates that, and in fact it's a standalone film as well, is The Queen of Versailles. Tell us a little bit about that.
The Queen of Versailles is really the allegory that kind of sits in the middle of this project, because they were a billionaire family who had a very rags-to-riches kind of American dream story, started with nothing, made their money in timeshare, which is luxury real estate, but luxury real estate for middle-class and working-class people in a way, so they can feel rich, which really speaks to the theme of the book. They decide to build a 90,000-square-foot palace inspired by Versailles in France in Orlando across from Disney World, and also a huge tower in Las Vegas. And even though David Siegel was a billionaire, this is the straw that breaks the camel's back. And after the financial crash, he ends up over-leveraged, and it becomes a supersized foreclosure story. When I saw that this could happen to a billionaire family and that what was happening to them looked so similar to what I had covered in the foreclosure crisis in California, in the crisis in Dubai, in Ireland, in Iceland, their story really made me realize that this was human behavior that was being repeated, and also forces from our society that was being repeated all over the world. And that's really where this book kind of started, is thinking about that.
And of course, this desire to acquire, if you like, or ostentatious affluence isn't new. I mean, the Queen of Versailles, of course, named after Versailles, we could go all the way back to Louis XIV and see that actually people have been after this globally for a long time.
Yeah, I think that the desire is not new, but I think the form is kind of on overdrive because of, during this period of these 25 years, advertising, direct marketing has increased so much. And the way the media transports this stuff has gone on kind of overdrive. So when I was starting, that was the beginning of MTV, and I was really looking at the imagery of hip-hop and how that was influencing kids from different backgrounds. And that was just the beginning. Then we went to thousands of cable channels, the internet, social media. Now kids are all branding and marketing themselves on social media, and everybody is kind of selling stuff in the background. And people are judging their friends by how many likes they have. And so I think the world has kind of changed so that image has become that much more important.
I'd like to go to the last chapter now, and a picture that I think for you really sums up the book. So the last chapter is called Make It Rain. And there is this huge double page spread. It's taken, I guess, in a strip club. A lot of semi-naked women, money, I guess that's the rain of the title, just flowing all over them, being thrown by people. It's the most extraordinary photograph in this kind of red light. Tell us a little bit about that and what it means.
Well, this was taken at a strip club called Magic City in Atlanta. And what really blew me away there is it was kind of this microcosm of the American dream in the most kind of raw transactional form, where people are throwing money up into the air to show what they have. The women who are the strippers there are actually considered the high-class socialites of Atlanta because of their beauty and because they make so much money. Rappers go there who have nothing but then can become millionaires, people like Future the rapper and Jeezy and some big stars. And there was a feeling after the crash happened, I thought that was going to be the morality tale that we were all going to learn from. And then there was this kind of post-crash, almost wealth destruction, where there was a feeling of live for today, show it off because you don't know what you'll have tomorrow. And so I end with these two clubs, one in Vegas where people spend up to $50,000 on a single night for bottle service, and this club in Atlanta where people, some who don't have much money at all, literally will throw thousands of dollar bills into the air to get attention so people look at them. And there was a feeling of dancing on the deck of the Titanic, kind of end of empire, which I felt kind of was the right tone for this cautionary tale to end on.
It's a multimedia project. Just tell us a little bit about what surrounds the book.
Yeah, there's an exhibition that's in LA now going to New York, and then it'll travel to Europe, that has projections and films, short films, long films, an original film that I made for the show, and photographs. And actually, the interviews are on the wall with almost equal weight as the photographs. I always felt like the voices of the subjects themselves, their point of view, was a really important piece of the storytelling. And I'm also making a feature-length film that will come out later this year.
Lauren, thank you so much. Lauren Greenfield, Generation Wealth, it's out now. It's published by Faden.
Thank you so much.
That was Lauren Greenfield speaking to Georgina Godwin a little earlier on. And Generation Wealth from Faden Books is out now. And you are tuned in to The Monocle Weekly. Aaron Holloway-Nahum is a composer and conductor who's written for outfits including the London Symphony Orchestra and the London Sinfonietta. And he's also the leader of Riot Ensemble, a group looking to bring contemporary, avant-garde and classical music to new settings and audiences.
As part of this, he's launched a new podcast called Chest of Toys, backed by the charity Sound and Music. It looks at how music can shape the environment, ranging from single individuals' careers to citywide music scenes, such as Chicago, which the most recent episode visits. Let's hear a clip of that episode first up. This is composer Augusta Reed Thomas explaining why she founded Chicago's contemporary music festival, Ear Taxi.
3 years ago, when I founded the Ear Taxi Festival, I was literally walking through Millennium Park, which is right near where I live, and I was thinking about all my friends that are making all this work, and I was going to several of their concerts that week, and thought to myself, why don't I just put together this massive, huge festival? And at that point, I should have shot myself in the head right at that minute, because it has been a massive three-year volunteer labor of love. But at that moment, it seemed so obvious to do it, because you have groups that have been thriving for a decade. And of course, there are several really famous composers in town, and then there's a whole bunch of emerging composers in town and some mid-career composers. There's a real ecosystem, and I thought, what if I could take all of that energy and expertise and love and blood, sweat, and tears that we're all putting into this and really put everyone on a major stage downtown in the center of the city? It's important for the architects, the dancers, the chefs, the bus drivers, and everyone else in the city to realize that right here we have one of the greatest scenes of new music, really in the world, in my opinion.
That was Augusta Reed Thomas there talking on the podcast Chest of Toys, the founder of which is Aaron Holloway-Nahum, and he's made it to the studio. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You've made it to the studio like it was a struggle. You're in the studio,
Wait,
I don't know.
It's bad weather today again, here. So yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in. Now, Augusta sounded great on that thing, and it gave our listeners a bit of a window into what you guys do. And it seems, at least there in Chicago, that it's not just on in the city, that it kind of becomes part of the city. Is that part of the aim of the game?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's so easy in any city to just have your own life and your own image of what goes on. And there's so much in every art form bubbling away beneath the surface. And new music is just like that. I mean, when you go to Chicago, and I was there for this festival, it was absolutely amazing. You know, 50 ensembles, 350 musicians, all of this ticking away. And to have it on that main stage, well, that was really, I think, something for those of us in the new music scene here to maybe aspire to,
yeah,
and to learn from, because the scene is just as vibrant here in London. I mean, you've got things like Non-Classical Nights and Sonic Imperfections going on down in Peckham. Just tonight, I'll be at Cafe Otto to hear Plus Minus Ensemble. I mean, the scene is vibrant, and it's bubbling and exciting and fun, and it's a part of what makes London or any great city what it is.
A vibrant, bubbling scene, but it's interesting that not everyone, I guess, is convinced. There are still some kind of skeptics out there, and actually the name of your podcast kind of speaks to that a bit, and I wondered whether you could sort of explain how that came about, where the Chest of Toys idea, how did that come about?
Yeah, so a few years ago, after the Huddersfield Festival of Contemporary Music, where we performed with Riot Ensemble a couple years ago, a comedian went on BBC Radio 3 and quoted an anonymous punter as saying, "The problem with so much contemporary music is it just sounds like a children's chest of toys falling down the stairs." I mean, I just have to be honest.
You thought no such thing as bad publicity.
No such thing. But also just, I mean, maybe that's part of what makes us in the new music scene who we are. We just love that kind of an image. I mean, I'm about to become a father. My son's going to arrive in June sometime. And I teach a lot of piano to young kids. And I can tell you that if I gave any of my students the choice between sitting at a piano lesson or filling a chest of toys and throwing it down some stairs,
yeah,
they would pick the latter. I mean, it's that kind of fascination and love of sound, of cacophony, of what is truly modern in music Because that's something about new music that really is modern. I mean, you think about the world we live in, the diversity of the world, the eclecticism, the conflict, all of those things. These are all things that are contained in the music that we love and make.
And when you're teaching, so you, as a teacher, are you teaching what we might call the classic classics, or are you teaching, are you throwing in techniques that will allow their mind to open up to new music? If you know what I mean. I mean,
yeah,
you're preparing the muscle kind of thing that they want to use later in life.
It's kind of a funny thing because a lot of studies that people have done actually show that a love for contemporary music, the kind of cacophony that we're talking about, that's actually innate. And when you start training people, the more they get trained, sometimes the harder it is for them to enjoy these things. I mean, there are jokes amongst, you'll hear actually in the third episode, if you tune in June, some of our musicians talking about what it's like for these scores to come in, and our pianist, who is a world-class pianist, I mean, can play, you know, has played Rachmaninoff concertos with orchestras, and he gets a score that comes in that says, rub a piano string with fishing wire for 5 minutes.
Right.
And he just thinks to himself, what am I doing with my life? You know? I mean, this is a kind of thing that we run into, but we try to treat it with good humor and fun. And for the kids, well, I mean, there are some great contemporary things for them to do, and I try to teach them a whole spectrum. I mean, of course, you're trying to give people a foundation, and music does teach things like discipline and the kind of geological nature of life. If you just like commit yourself to something for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, you get good at it over time, and you try to teach people that. But on the other hand, well, we want to have fun. I mean, that's at the heart of everything that we're doing. We're trying to have a great time, and that's in my teaching, in my conducting, in my composing, and definitely in Chest of Toys.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that idea of discipline, because particularly with teaching, I guess, students or young people, there is this idea that you need to be able to sustain a disciplined approach. You need to be able to address something very complex with a certain kind of rigor to get to a level of success. So I suppose what you're saying is, yes, that is still important, but you need to also work on the disordered part. You need to work on the free form. And that's, I guess, a hard thing for someone to get to grips with, the idea that it can maybe take even more work to do something that's essentially more random or more explosive.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose any day that you walk through the Tate Modern, there must be someone there who looks at that Jackson Pollock and says to the person next to them, well, I could do that. This is like, you know, ridiculous, or it's like a white canvas. And I'm sure, you know, you come to a Riot Ensemble concert and some people think, well, I could make that noise on the clarinet. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you look at some of these scores, I mean, I don't know if there's any way for your audience to see some things, but I can send you some PDFs of some of the things that our musicians have to accomplish. It is so incredibly virtuosic. It is so difficult. I mean, you have things like asking people to play 17 notes in the time where they would normally play 15 notes. And they're doing that while someone else is playing 9 notes. And they have to align on the last of those notes. I was editing
It sounds completely a torturous process. Why do you do these things to people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the kind of, but you know, think about the things that we love. Think about the things that you would go to the British Museum to see. This is the kind of stuff like a, you know, it's a plate. You're like, it's a plate. And you look at it and you realize someone spent 6 months making this plate. And that's the thing that still matters to us. I mean, in some ways, it's the only thing we still have in some instances. But it's a thing that communicates humanity forward. And we think, you know, being dedicated to something like that in an era when the people who are supposed to be the most responsible in the world are firing off tweets and doing all sorts of nonsense at any given moment of any given day, you say, no, that is not the only thing it means to be a human being in 2017. We're not just vapid. We're not just impulsive. But, you know, I just want to temper that by also saying, we're not putting on academic lectures. You don't come to a Riot Ensemble concert and get handed an essay book.
Yeah.
It's certainly not as big as your magazine, which I love, by the way. I love the magazine for long-haul flights. But, you know, we're having a great time, but trying to say and do something serious.
Well, power to you and power to Chest of Toys. That is the podcast. Listeners must check out what all this stuff sounds like rather than just listen to the clip that we heard at the top of that segment. Aaron Holloway-Nahum, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
That's it, Tom. Edition 411 of the Monocle Weekly, right there. Atcha, coming atcha.
What a way to spend your Sunday lunchtime. It's funny, this show, it's intriguing. There's always light and shade. We always talk about that. But very interesting. Stories to set your teeth on edge, literally and metaphorically. Music. What else do we do? The allure of wealth. All sorts.
Let's thank our friends behind the glass, shall we?
They certainly deserve it. The programme was produced, as ever, by Tom Hall. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. The show returns next week. Who knows who'll be here, Rob? Perhaps you and I? Perhaps somebody else?
Who knows? Who knows? The listeners will simply have to kind of like throw their die into the roulette wheel of the Monocle 24 radio station.
And to end, as we begin, it'll be a conga line of all the editorial talents parading, sashaying through Studio One. Through. Take your pick as who might be behind the microphones.
All right, then. For me, Robert Bowne.
And for me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.